Hello, and welcome to Adelaide Writers' Week. I'm Jo Case, and I'm the Deputy Books and Ideas Editor of The Conversation and a monthly books columnist at In Review. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains and to pay respect to elders past and present. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and continuing relationship with the land. And we acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living here today. I'm really thrilled to be here today with Lynn Malcolm to talk about her fascinating book, All in the Mind, which is based on the popular ABC radio program and podcast, which she produced and presented for 9 years. As many of you may be, I'm a huge fan of All in the Mind, which is one of the most downloaded ABC podcasts in Australia and internationally. I have to say, right now, I feel like I'm sitting alongside someone who has accompanied me on many walks and bus journeys and kept me company while I cooked many dinners. I guess that's the magic of radio and podcasts. Thank you, Lynn.
Pleasure.
Lynn is a science journalist and a broadcaster with a deep passion and fascination for people, their behaviour and the workings of the human mind. Lynn has received numerous awards and contributes to media award judging panels, including the Australian Museum's Eureka Awards and the Mental Health Service of Australia and New Zealand Media Awards. She continues to write, podcast and communicate about the topics she's inspired by. Just going to pause for the sirens. It's proving tricky to pause for the sirens. Okay. All in the Mind, Lynn's first book, draws on her many interviews with neuroscientists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and the people they help. In it, Lynn takes us on a fascinating journey to discover how this new knowledge is not only changing the way we understand the brain, but changing lives. There are stories in here about consciousness and perception, sleep, dreaming and hallucinations, of memory, identity, creativity and the mind-body connection, and of mental illness and recovery. I have to say, I first expected this book, as it's based on a podcast, to be a collection of interviews for her, from her shows. But I was really pleased and delighted to find that it's much more than that. Lynn has synthesised her interviews with her own research, and each chapter reads as a fascinating dive into its topic, combining professional expertise with personal experience. And before I dive into my conversation with Lynn, I'll remind you of this at the end, but Lynn will be signing copies of this excellent book at the book tent at the end of the session. Please join me in welcoming Lynn here. And now let's hear from Lynn. Can you tell us about how you first became interested in the mind?
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't really think about this until I came to writing the book. I thought, where did this curiosity come from? Why have I been so driven from, you know, my university days, even much earlier, to be interested in the brain, the mind, psychology? And I think partly it comes back to when I was a young child, I did have anxiety. I had free-floating anxiety. I'd be concerned about walking to school on my own. I was scared about what might happen on the way to school. I was always worried about people that were less well-off or less safe than I was. I was anxious about violence. I couldn't... And I'd be... in tears a lot. And of course, this worried my mother. And she, and this is quite unusual for probably I suppose it was about the mid-60s, she took me off to a therapist, a counsellor. And the counsellor had sort of asked me about my dreams, my inner thoughts, and I loved the idea that she talked to me about my dreams because I've always been also fascinated about dreams, and I loved talking about that. She got me to draw, and I was fascinated by the process. And then after a while, my mother decided, I don't think it was for that long really, but my mother decided that I was getting too anxious about the next session. Aww. So we weren't going to go anymore. who knows, that might have been a good call, I don't know. So there was that, and then, and I also think that there was something that was unsaid in my mother's life that, I'm not saying it was a particular, I never sort of found out about it, but she always had a bit of an edge, a bit of an anxious edge about her. Mm. But I was also fascinated by her ability to tell stories, and I used to sort of sit in on her and her sister when they were having gas bagging, you know, having chats and funny. They were hilarious. They were both hilarious. And I was just like intrigued about this, the stories about people, about other people, you know. Mm. And then as I went through school and got to university, I just knew, but before I went to university, that I wanted to study psychology. Mm. And so I did that and really loved it, but I ended up not going straight into working into clinical psychology as I thought I would, but ended up serendipitously in the ABC in broadcasting and telling stories, combining science with personal history, personal stories. So I ended up in this dream job, All in the Mind, which was perfect. It just pulled together all my very early interests with also the love that I'd developed of communicating science. So that's
such a great combination of, like we were talking before about, you know, the way that your interests and your experiences and background came together to really make you, I think, a perfect person for your job, for what you've done. And listening to you talk about how much you enjoyed your therapy sessions and what led you to them also makes me think that kind of like, I mean, rumination is not always great for you as a person, as yourself, but it's a terrific tool, like having a curious analytical mind that goes over things and tries to find answers. Surely that's actually a pretty good thing for a journalist, especially a science
exactly.
journalist.
Exactly. I think it comes from the same place, I think.
Yeah. Mm. you've put it to good use. Excellent. There are so many interesting things in this book, and I think there are a few concepts that really run through it and keep recurring. And one of those, which you very wisely put towards the beginning of the book, is neuroplasticity. Oh gosh, I can't believe I couldn't say that. Neuroplasticity, a term that was first introduced in around 2007 with Dr. Norman Doidge's bestseller, The Brain That Changes Itself. Can you explain to us a bit about what that means, what that concept means?
So the brain is like a big computer that controls the brain and the mind. Mm. And it does that through neurons that communicate with each other, through transmitter chemicals, neurotransmitters. And we used to think that neurons... you're born with a certain number of neurons and then that's it for the rest of your life. Mm. But in more recent times, we've learnt that the neurons actually increase up until when you're in early adulthood. I think you have something like 15,000 neurons. And also that they increase, but also they after a while, particularly at adolescence, actually, they start pruning away, they call it. So the neurons that used to communicate together drop off according to how often they're used and how often those pathways are used. So they sort of prune down so that you're left with the connections that you really need and you use over and over again. Mm. It's also found that we can increase those pathways, we can form new pathways, and even new neurons can be formed right through our lives, which was quite a revelation. And so it's all dependent on the environment that you live in and your activity and what you do with your brain. So it offers, neuroplasticity is key to just about everything. Mm. It offers so much potential of hope and healing, as we've heard way back from Norman Doidge on. But it's also interesting to sort of understand that neuroplasticity also contributes to less positive things. So if you're in an environment where, less positive things are happening, if you've been in trauma or you've been in environments that aren't as good for you, then those pathways start being stronger and it can lead to damage and mental health. So, yeah, it's important to sort of realise that it offers a lot of hope for healing, but it's not a magic bullet, and it also contributes to less desirable experiences and characteristics. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, it seems like it's a really positive thing in terms of a tool. Like, so much knowledge is that helps us understand why things are happening and how we can address things, and how in some cases where we didn't see solutions to things, we've managed, doctors have managed to find them through using the theory of neuroplasticity.
Mm.
One story that you use in the book that's really interesting to illustrate neuroplasticity is that of cognitive scientist Clark Elliott, who, after his accident, said he felt like his real self had left his brain and he was a ghost in his body. And he was prescribed a special pair of glasses. Can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, he was actually an AI specialist as well.
And oh, wow.
This was a number of years ago. And he started noticing in himself the impact of the traumatic concussion that he ended up with after the accident. And he was so curious and such a scientist that he wanted to get to the bottom of it. And he'd also been inspired by Norman Doidge and his talk about brain plasticity. Anyway, he investigated, and came across two people who really led to largely to his healing. And one was a cognitive scientist, and one was an optometrist. And so the cognitive scientist set him puzzles, brain puzzles and brain tricks, and that he was to practice every single day. And the idea of that was to start forming new brain pathways that he'd lost. And then the optometrist, which is a wild area.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear sort of more about this, that she had done some research in connecting one's visual abilities with connecting it with auditory abilities. And she's developed this particular system, and she devised these glasses, these spectacles that actually trained him to tune in to a sound in connection to his peripheral vision.
Mm.
And the combination of those two things, and of course he was very conscientious, And he did all those, and the combination of these two things led to his recovery. He described to me at one stage where he arrived home one day, put his key in the front door, and he suddenly had this kind of realization that what he felt like, his identity, himself, which was, he felt like it was outside his body, was like the ghost that was outside his body since the accident, started to come back into his body, and he felt like one integrated person.
Wow.
Now, it is an extreme story, but it just demonstrates how, you know, there are ways to sort of work on redefining and etching out those pathways.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Obviously, he's someone who was well equipped to do the work of finding solutions and applying them. Mm. But obviously it's a great story.
Yeah.
And that does actually, when you're talking about that as reintegration, it's just occurred to me, I think we'll talk about this a bit later, but that idea of feeling disconnected from parts of the self and healing coming through or becoming a more whole person, integrating those parts that have become disconnected is often a way of people healing or just becoming more mentally healthy, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, I'd love to talk about, I think, what you're referring to later. Yeah.
Yeah. Your section on memory is really fascinating, and you've got a couple of terrific stories that I'd just like to get you to share with the audience. And the first one is Henry, who lost his ability to lay down new long-term memories as a result of an operation that was designed to cure his epileptic fits. Can you tell us about Henry and what happened to him?
Yeah, he had an operation that they thought was going to help him with his epileptic fits. His name is Henry Mollison, and he became known later as HM, and he has been, his case has been renowned in psychology courses for years and years and years. The research that came from his case study has contributed big time to new memory research. and so they gave him an operation which actually sucked out a large proportion of the hippocampus and the amygdala. And we know that these are the two places where long-term conscious memories reside, or they're stored. And so as a result of that, he lost the ability to lay down new long-term memories. And it was like he lived in a permanent present tense. Mm. And I spoke to the researcher, Suzanne Corkin, who's now deceased. But she worked with him for years and years and years. And she actually wrote a book on this, and it was called Permanent Present Tense. She talked about her relationship and the working with Henry over a long period of time. So some of the things that he studied in infinitum, and apparently he was so good-natured about it and loved the idea that he was contributing to memory research. Mm-hmm. He showed that, you know, you could be quite an intelligent person but still have a dreadful memory. Mm. Now, that's encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
And he showed that not all kinds of learning are impaired in amnesia, and the ability to form memories is localised to very specific parts of the brain. So his contribution was enormous. Mm. And we also know that partly from this case, that memory is very closely connected to emotions. Mm. And, you know, for example, some tests that were done on Henry were done about what he remembered before the operation and after the operation. And interestingly, he only remembered some of the things before the operation, and some sort of key international events, or you know, in the public eye. He remembered some of them that meant something to him, had some emotional connection. Like, I think he remembered something. Oh, he remembered about JFK being shot, and he remembered about. He loved Liza Minnelli, and he remembered, you know. So, but other things he just didn't have any idea about. But these were the things that he really connected with on an emotional level. So that was a really big contribution to the understanding about memory as well.
And that also is quite interesting in terms of what it says about our identity, because obviously even though he'd lost so much, that just shows the imprint of his personality was still there. That's quite touching.
It was. But also what he lost meant that he actually lost touch with what he was like now.
Yeah.
So he'd changed physically a lot, and he described himself as physically the way he was, and couldn't bring those two things together. So
that's really
identity is very, very much affected, but it's lovely to know that there are some things that just remain throughout.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And again, I feel like that idea of how our brain contributes to or manifests what makes us who we are is something that pops up again and again in the book in really interesting ways as well.
Exactly.
So, yeah. On the other end of the memory spectrum, can you tell us a bit, and this is the story maybe as a writer, I found this incredibly interesting, Rebecca Sharrock, who is one of approximately 60 known people in the world who can't forget a single day of her life and has highly superior autobiographical memory. And while my initial reaction is that sounds amazing, I'd love to have it, there are real weaknesses or problems for that too. Can you tell us a bit about her story?
Yeah, superior autobiographical memory. So when I first spoke to her, I asked the obvious question, what's your earliest memory? and she talked about she said, I just remember everything throughout my whole life, you know. Mm. But she talked about, I was lying on the car seat of my parents' car next to the steering wheel, and I remember this fluffy cover, you know, on the steering wheel. I remember looking up at my parents, and they were holding a camera in front of me, and I thought, what is that? I don't know what that is. What are they doing? You know, and so she had that really early memory, and she said, and I do have some memory of when I was first born, and I was lying in a bed surrounded by glass walls. Mm-hmm. And obviously it was the humidity crib.
Wow.
She was, you know. And then she talked about memories where she another memory was when she fell over when she was 3 years old, and she grazed her knee, and she cried and cried and cried. The pain was immense when you're little and something like that happens. It's terrible. She, even to this day, she can't not feel that to the extent that she felt it when she was little. So she says, people think I'm really, you know, a wuss, whatever, but I feel it like I did then, you know, like. And I found out that she was a first of all, I decided to sort of pick out some dates, random dates in history, and say, what do you remember about that date, you know? And there were I think one of them was like 4th of September 2006, you know, and I'd had a bit of a look on the net about, you know, what things happened then. She said, oh, yeah, that was the day that Steve Irwin died. She said, and I was devastated because I loved him. He was my hero, and he got, you know, and I really remember that. That was such a sad day. And I'm going, whoa. And then the 22nd of January 2008, she said, oh, yes, that's the day we woke up, and in the newspaper there was a volcanic eruption in Iceland.
Wow.
And, yeah, there were several things like that. It was just a knockout. Mm. And then I knew that she was a Harry Potter fan. And so I picked out three random paragraphs from all those books, and I asked her to follow with what the next paragraph was. And she did it down to a T, you know.
Wow.
I gave her the first sentence. She said, oh, yes, that's from book blah, blah, chapter blah, blah. And then she followed with the next paragraph of what was written in the book, you know.
Mm.
So it was like, it was extraordinary. And then, of course, I had to sort of ask her, well, is it a gift or a curse? And she said, well, look, I'm growing to appreciate it as a gift, but it has caused a lot of anguish in my life and a lot of anxiety, because sometimes she'd go to bed at night and she'd just have these thoughts over and over and over again, like from throughout her whole life. You know, she didn't have that kind of pruning that
yeah, wow.
to remember. But then and she said, anyway, I'm writing a book, and it's helping me to, you know, to value it. And but she was also very happy to be contributing to research on HSAM in Australia, because there's only like one researcher in Australia.
Wow.
Who's looking at this, and she's proud to be contributing. But she said, I am writing a book, and guess what? It's an autobiography.
I'm going, you have to put that to use.
How do you do that? Anyway, she didn't tell me any more of the horrific details that must be involved in editing.
I was just thinking that would be the problem, editing the book. Wow. Yeah, I found it really moving. The bit where she talked about, as you just said, finding it hard to fall asleep because she can't turn off the memories.
Yeah.
And feeling all the feelings at the same time. It really gave me that feeling of, you know, stories you sometimes read, usually like science fiction, where it's like you have this superpower, but it's also a curse. And yes,
yeah,
super interesting to know that there's something like that is real. And yeah.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, these two cases I'm talking about, it's not just sort of looking at, you know, freak people with freak abilities, but it's, and that's the case with a lot of these differences in perception, and is how important they are to understand.
Yes.
So that we can understand memory per se, you know, or understand any of these things per se. So that looking deeply into the extremes is a really important contribution.
Mm. Absolutely. It's a great kind of illustration from using either extreme at the whole spectrum of how memory functions.
Mm.
And also I think by the way that you, like, talk to these people and find out, and talk to people who've worked with them and find out how these things are positive and negative, you make them, as you say, not into, you know, freaks, but people, and you can see how that might be. And I think that's the way you do that throughout the book is a really valuable part of it. And obviously the way you did it in the program. So,
yeah.
Another concept that runs through the book is the idea, or in some of the stories, is the idea of neurodiversity, which was invented by Australian sociologist Judy Singer, whose mother and daughter were autistic, and she had autistic traits herself in the late 90s. And I feel like this is something that's more and more talked about and known, but probably wasn't when you covered it. Can you just explain what that is?
Mm. Concept of neurodiversity challenges our notions of what has been thought of as normal, mentally normal, and it's become really a revolutionary cultural movement based on understanding a unique way of perceiving the world and seeing things differently.
Mm.
And Judy Singer way back, you know, in the late 90s, drew attention to how damaging societal attitudes are to people with autism, for example, who want to broaden the public's acceptance of difference. And the concept of neurodiversity has extended beyond autism, and so it's understanding all sorts of different ways of perceiving, and we can talk more about those. But it's been a little bit controversial as well, because some people really want to identify, say, as being autistic, or, you know, other people don't. And they can feel like they're discriminated against, you know. Mm. So there's a lot of discussion and a lot of interesting speculation around the concept. But I think broadly, the concept of neurodiversity is extremely important to contribute to our empathy in our society and understanding of everybody.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. It kind of illustrates that different brains work in different ways, doesn't it? And that's a really good starting point for all kinds of discussions. Autism is one neurodivergent condition, and you've talked to a range of autistic people who represent a diverse sample of what autism is, how it can present. One of those is John Elder Robison, who I've actually also interviewed, and he's a fascinating character. You say you were surprisingly moved by his story. Can you tell us a bit about John?
Yeah, I was very moved. He is an autistic advocate and author now, and he's in his 60s, and he described himself as an unwanted child, one who was bullied. No one would play with him. He was referred to the weird guy and was bullied, and it was very painful and isolating for him. He failed school grades because of that pressure, and he became very angry and left school early to join a rock and roll band as a sound engineer. And he...
Kiss.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he became, he had developed great pride in how he was really good at it and had a lot of pride in that, in making these bands sound terrific technically, you know. Mm. One of the things that he was most proud of was he was the sound engineer for a concert done by Kiss. And apparently, I actually don't remember this, but there was a guy in the band Kiss called Ace Frehley, who had this kind of stage act of having his guitar smoking.
Yes.
And he developed that whole thing of, you know, making that happen, and he was very proud of all that. But, you know, he was kind of still, you know, his nickname was Ampy, and but, you know, he took great pride in what he did. He was 40 before he realised that he was on the autism spectrum. He was working in a car repair business at that point, and one of his clients kind of came along and said, customers, and said, "Have you ever thought about," you know, he kind of started noticing this. Anyway, he got checked out, and he was diagnosed to be on the autism spectrum. And for him, this diagnosis was liberating for him, because for the first time in his life, he had a non-judgmental explanation for the difference. Mm. And he no longer kind of believed that he was stupid or defective. You know, it helped him a lot. Mm. And then from that time, he went on to learn ways of social perception, and he emulated other people, and so that he could kind of be closer to communicating with people in a kind of more normal way, so that he was understood. And he improved his communication skills and understood the difference between the way he sees things and the way others see things. And then through that became an autism advocate. But one story I wanted to tell you about him was that he also had some brain stimulation therapy that he was approached by some researchers to say, you know, would you be interested in this? We think that this might help with your awareness about others. Mm. And he said, oh, yeah, sure, why not? And so he had a few sessions of brain stimulation and didn't notice much difference. And then after, you know, a couple of sessions, and he was driving home, he described driving home from one of the sessions, and he always put on recordings of, you know, these old bands that he used to work for in the car to listen to how great is the quality of that sound. Didn't I do well? You know, like he'd do that often. Mm. And this time he put the music on, and suddenly he felt like this flood of emotion, like for the first time he felt the emotion of the music. Because we all know that music carries so much emotion, or many of us know that, but he felt this flood of emotion. That must be what many other people have felt all the time, and I've never got that. Mm. And he was driving along with tears flooding down his face because I've just had an insight into that new kind of way of perceiving, you know?
Yeah, that was an extraordinary story, and the technology involved in that, you know, like very pioneering and
it's important to sort of note that it's still, you know, the jury is still out about whether it's called transcranial magnetic brain stimulation. It's used for a number of things and it's still being researched. The jury is still out about, you know, how effective is it, and you know, people are really working on it, but he obviously had some effect, you know.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's so interesting. That story makes me think of what we were just talking about before with Clark, which is, you know, that some technology that stimulated different parts of his brain suddenly made him, you know, different parts of the world come into focus and him see it in a different way again. So obviously there's a lot that can be done like that. The other interesting thing, I was going to ask you to go into a couple of other autistic people who present a range, but so that we get to other things, I won't. I'll quickly mention them, though, which you talked to Tim Sharp, who is a non-verbal autistic man, or you talked to his mother, Judy, who's terrific at drawing and has had art exhibitions. You also talked to a UK autistic woman, Hannah Belcher, who gave you an idea of how autism could present differently in women who are more likely to mask to fit in socially. So there's a huge range there. And the story you just told about John is so interesting also, in that when he talks about being flooded with this deep emotion, that is, I'll say, I am also an autistic woman, and you know, autism can present in so many different ways, but one of the ways it can be different, and I think more often in women, is that you can, instead of not experiencing emotion, being disconnected from it, can feel it very, very intensely. So what John had is, it's really interesting.
And I know we don't have time to go into it, but that thing about women with autism are so often underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed because they have a different way of a social ability, and they find ways of what they call masking, sort of covering up things, and that makes it harder because often, you know, women aren't diagnosed often enough, and therefore they suffer and feel like it's a mental health issue rather than something that could be helped. Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, that's the other thing that I thought of when you were just saying that John felt that from that experience he was able to more accurately, I guess, perform emotion or social things. That's what a lot of autistic women do. So
Teach themselves.
Absolutely. Such a huge, there are so many things in this book to talk about. I hate skipping over that, but I think dementia is one I'd really like to touch on because it's something that affects so many people. Around 450,000 Australians are living with some form of dementia. And you have experienced it through your father and your mother, who both had it. Can you tell us a bit about that aspect of the book, what you've found out, and perhaps, you know, why was it important for you to have that as a key aspect of the book? And was it hard to write about?
So my father developed dementia. I mean, what they say about dementia is that it starts long before it's recognised.
Mm.
So I look back and I think, oh, you know, I saw things then, but I didn't realise then. But yeah, so he had vascular dementia, and my mother was, you know, looking after him, and it became very hard, of course, on her and on the family. Mm. It's very sad. You know, they do kind of lose a lot of their identity, and that was very sad. He died though sort of fairly suddenly from a heart attack, just as it was really just about time for him to go into a care home, residential care. And then my mother, she went into a hole because suddenly she was so used to sort of looking after him. And she forgot about herself, she forgot about her identity, she forgot how to be, I think she forgot how to be happy, and eventually she went into a home too, an aged care home. But she, developed dementia in that short amount of time. It was very hard to write about in the book. And actually, when I first started writing the book, she was in the care home, and in the middle of pulling the book together, she died.
Oh.
And I was very, very privileged, along with my daughter, to be at her bedside for years before we would go and visit her. You would just go, well, I don't know, do you know me or don't you? She became non-verbal as well, so I couldn't even talk to her, or, you know, and she'd just sort of stare at me, and then as if she was almost like staring, she was staring into the distance behind me. And yeah, that thing of just not knowing was so hard. And I remember one time my brother and I went in to visit her, and I'd heard this, you know, the strength of music that can sometimes tap into, you know, people's memories, and which certainly can. But Peter and I went in and played a couple of tracks of music that we knew that she and Dad used to listen to, and it was just... the music was so meaningful still to us, you know, and I kind of put the phone next to the bed and played this music, and we were just going, like, watching, hoping, is she... And, look, it was barely perceptible that she was moved by it, which is so devastating. It was, you know, so too late. So I... however... it was important to be there.
Yes, yes.
For us, anyway, and I think for her too. Occasionally you'd see a little glimmer in her eye, or, you know. So I guess that's just, yeah, and so many people have experienced this, so many people in all sorts of different ways. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and... I mean, that experience, I found that really moving, that part in the book, obviously, where you write about that. And, you know, you do say, it's interesting because you've also you've talked to people who had been in comas, or, you know, who hadn't had consciousness, and they had this rich inner workings that were happening. So, I mean, was that kind of knowledge useful to you in being able to go, well, that may have had an effect that I just couldn't see?
Yeah, I think it did. It has consoled me to think, well, at the time it kind of feels like, what, you know, what good is it being here? But I believe now much more strongly that just being there, you know, and we know that even, like, you know, social connection remains... Well, it's important to everyone all our lives, but it remains really important long into... you know, to even into the illness of dementia, or into long into old age, even if people can't, you know, verbalise it.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, what reading your book across all these sections also in different areas of the brain reveals is, you know, it's a journey through these constant layers being unearthed of new knowledge that sheds light on things that we weren't aware of before. So, you know, I guess.
Yeah, it's a absolutely exciting and fascinating field, and, you know.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's why I listen to the podcast. I am going to give a very brief opportunity to the audience to ask questions in about 5 minutes. If you have an idea for a question, try to keep it like short and succinctly phrased, because we are short for time, but come up to the microphone now if you are wanting to ask a question in a few minutes. But in the meantime, I did really want to ask you about dissociative identity disorder, which I obliquely referred to before, because it seems like some of your most moving and memorable encounters were with two women who had that dissociative identity disorder, and your exploration of that really debunks some pop cultural myths as well. Can you tell us what that is and how it's linked to trauma through the stories of those women?
Yeah, so dissociation is something that happens within a range of different disorders, and it's where the person's identity gets split off from reality.
Yeah,
and it actually serves as a protection mechanism. Dissociative identity disorder is when usually it starts as a result of extreme trauma, often in childhood and often ongoing. Trauma in childhood, and the person splits off their identity to protect themselves. So the Kalina was the first person that I spoke to with this disorder, and I was just blown away by the conversation we had. I had been told that she had had therapy over 20 years and she had become integrated, but at the height of her, and she only realised that there was something different about her, despite feeling like she had all these, she liked to call them, they're referred to as alters, so they're like personalities, but they're not personalities, but they're identities that the person creates for themselves to cope with certain things. So
compartmentalised.
And so Kalina had, I said, how many identities do you have, you know? And she said, oh, too many to name. But she had, you know, somewhat, you know, she was a young girl who liked sport, a person who spoke another language. Some of them wore glasses, some of them were nervous, some of them were overly confident. She rattled off all these different identities that would come forward for her within herself whenever she was, like, disturbed or challenged by what was happening in her life. And when I spoke to her, she was just so... she was so grounded and so real and authentic, and knowing that she was living with this in kind of silence behind her. Anyway, she eventually got some therapy, and it has to be very, very carefully managed, well-managed therapy. She was able to, the therapist was able to help her integrate by even engaging with the different personalities separately with her, you know. And then a while after that, I was approached by a woman who'd written a book about her experience of dissociative identity disorder, Rhonda, and she... And I read the book. She wrote this book that she self-published, and it was a description about the horrific trauma that she'd experienced throughout her life, through her childhood. Just like, it upset me immensely. I thought, can this be real? You know, can this be real? I have to be careful. I'm putting it on the, you know, on the radio. I have to kind of... Anyway, I made the decision that, yes, this is real. Because I'd had this experience with Kalina and I understood, you know, that these things... Anyway, when Rhonda came in, she just said, look, before we start, I really want you to tell me if you think I'm mad, you know, before we do the... I said, well, and it really took me back.
Wow.
I said, well, look, no, I don't, because I have understood from my previous experience with Kalina that this is a very real thing and you know, I really appreciate you talking to me about it. And anyway, so she told me the story and her identities were just, she created this amazingly complex... almost like a science fiction type story about and all these characters that sort of fitted in here, there and everywhere into her life. And that's how she managed her to survive.
Yeah.
And she also was lucky enough to eventually get good therapy. It took a while to get someone who helped her integrate. But both of them, interestingly, both said that actually, even though they're sort of fully integrated, they kind of miss some of those parts, some of those altars. You know, they were kind of friends as well as reminders, as well as guides, you know, and it's this intricate sort of relationship that they have.
So interesting. Mm. Yeah.
And I guess that, you know, those two stories affected me so much because it just made me realise what a spectacular thing the human mind is,
you know. To build that to kind build of, that. And not just one person, but that's a common thing, absolutely.
Mm.
I found that so interesting in many ways, including that I think the fact that the therapy for that was for, in both cases, for the therapist to recognise the altars and then integrate them is so telling for me about all different, like it, that spreads across different kinds of mental health treatment, that it used to be that you would deny things were happening or kind of ignore the patient's experience, and more it's coming towards that, how important it is to recognise it and build on that.
That's right. And, you know, and that comes up in, you know, treatment and approach to people who hear voices as well.
Yes, exactly.
Hallucinations.
Yeah.
Where, yeah, you know, 70% of people with schizophrenia have auditory hallucinations and hear voices, and, of course, medication is necessary.
Yeah.
Others hear voices... sometimes they don't have any kind of mental illness at all, but they hear voices, or they hear voices as a result of, you know, part of a depression or part of an anxiety. Well, we all have our voices, don't we?
Kind
of. And it's just a matter of managing them. But one of the kind of really encouraging approaches in treating hearing voices is to acknowledge those voices, to even allow the voices to interact with one another, for the therapist to interact with the voices as well as the person, and to acknowledge the role that those voices are playing for that person. So it's...
Absolutely.
It's encouraging, you know, new approaches to that.
Absolutely. And before I briefly pass on to get an audience question, I just... You and I talked about the fact that, you know, when you said it was hard to believe these stories and were that extreme, that it's something that we're seeing with, you know, the Royal Commissions on institutional abuse, for instance, that, you know, these things that have long been dismissed because it couldn't be true because it just seems too extreme. You know, we need to be able to look at them and see that these things do exist. And I feel like we were going to go into trauma as well. Please read the book for the way that Lynn really beautifully unpacks all that's involved in that, because I think it's really important for us all to understand. Yeah.
Mm.
A question.
Quick question.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For your talk. Is neurodiversity the new normal? Because for God's sake, what's normal?
Well, I think you probably nailed it. What's normal? No, I mean, I don't think it's the new normal, but, you know, we hear this term neurotypical as the alternative to neurodiversity. I just think neurodiversity is a very encouraging opening up of understanding, broadly understanding everybody, you know, the different ways that everybody perceives what's going on around us. And the more that we can understand that, the more we can empathise and the more humanity we can maintain in society.
Mm. Yes, I thought so. Would you say, Lynn, that it's somewhat about recognising what's out there and reframing the conversation around that?
Yeah. I think so, for sure.
Great,
yeah.
Thanks. Great, thank great you. Question. Love your brevity. Yes.
Hi, Lynn. Hi. I don't mean to be judgmental in asking this question. If you can't answer it, that's fine. I speak as what we call a carer of somebody in this system. I'm reading Kay Redfield Jamison.
Can you just repeat that?
And reading Kay Redfield Jamison's experience. She had bipolar and she was a psychiatrist in America. Why are so many mental health professionals, public and private, so seemingly uncaring, detached, judgmental of those with serious mental illness, particularly the ones that had attained under the Mental Health Act? It's a bit of an awkward question.
It's a very sad point that you make, and I don't think there is an answer. However, I think that part of the thing is that perhaps in our society we're not resourcing and valuing those carers, those mental health carers, nearly enough. There's not enough money put to it. There's not enough emphasis on the extreme importance of really being humane and maintaining a huge degree of empathy for these people with different experiences. And is that... I'm sorry, your mic's gone for some reason. I'm not sure what... Yeah. I think that's a sadness, and I think we need to really try and bring that home to those in power and those who have the resources to say, hey, this is a very significant area. I was listening to Patrick McGorry in a session earlier in the week, and he said that there's, what's it called, the Australian Mental Health Australia or something like that. It's an organisation that he encouraged everybody to sign up for, register for and show your support in. Because we've got to get that message up to those who are in power.
Yeah. Thanks. That's a really complex question, a really interesting point. Mm. Yeah. Did we have one other last question there? Yes? Just in time?
Oh, I don't know what happened to the mic, but...
I don't know. Yeah, this is the last one. Oh, right, doesn't work. Oh, I'm sorry. You might want to come and see Lynn at the tent and ask her your question with your book in hand. That gives me, lucky me, time for one last little question for Lynn. You talked to Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, the author of The Body Keeps the Score, the book on trauma that became an unlikely bestseller during COVID, and I was really interested in your discussion with him. He believes the key to understanding trauma lies in the connection between the brain and the body. Can you just briefly speak to that? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, look, he's very interesting, and I've got a whole section in the book on the body-mind connection, and this is what he really tunes into. And down to the point of trauma, and interestingly, with trauma, one of the key things in the way that the brain is affected with trauma, it actually affects the language section of the brain. So it's like, you know, that sort of the question about the silent scream, you know, it's not always easy for people to talk about trauma. They become silent, they get cut off. And so Bessel van der Kolk has really tuned into what a singular kind of being we are in terms of the mind and the body connected. And he does amazing treatment with even, you know, little kids right through. He uses yoga, he uses body therapy, he uses massage, and people can kind of tune in into expressing their psychological experience through the body rather than just going, talk about it, you know. Mm. And now, you know, it's become much less promoted for people to encourage people to talk about, oh, what just happened, you know, like talk about what just happened. Well, that's not really the thing to do now. And to acknowledge that very important connection between the brain and the mind is exactly what he's done. He's quite an amazing guy. And, you know, a little bit controversial, though, in the sort of, more traditional psychiatric circles. He's not completely accepted, but...
Yeah, it's really interesting. I actually heard an interview he gave someone on another podcast recently where he has some feelings about the way his book's been interpreted, but, you know, that's if we had more time, which we don't. I think that's a really nice way to end it because we're coming back to that idea of integration and how important that is and the sense in the mind and body. Thank you so much. You've been a great audience, great questions. And please do remember Lynn will be at the tent signing her books.
Thanks.